Hello, and welcome to 30 Minutes On, a podcast from American University Magazine. I'm American Magazine staff writer Andrew Erickson. Today in our winter episode, we're spending 30 minutes on fire safety. You probably already know this, but in the winter months when we crank up the heat, doing anything we can to keep our homes nice and toasty, we're also cranking up the danger. According to the National Fire Protection Association, about half of home heating fires occur in December, January, and February. And from 2014 to 2018, there was an average of 48,530 home fires in the United States involving heating equipment, from furnaces to space heaters. Mitchell Canry, a 2005 graduate of the School of Public Affairs, is constantly beating the drum of fire safety, he says. It's his job. Well, that and fire investigations, fire inspections, code changes, and policy. Since late 2020, he's been the D.C. Fire Marshal, the latest and highest position in a D.C. fire career that began 18 years ago, while he was still an undergraduate student at AU. In September, Canry joined 30 Minutes On to discuss his career in D.C. fire, from firehouses to fire inspection, his last couple years as D.C.'s fire marshal, and how you and your family can make a fire plan this winter. Here's our interview with Mitchell. So Mitchell, thank you again for taking the time to join us. We really appreciate getting the chance to chat with you again. So I guess just to get started, I know a fire marshal oversees a mix of investigation, code enforcement, and inspections, but in a given week, what does that typically mean for you and your team? And what does that mean in terms of what you oversee on a daily basis?
Yeah, so in the DC Fire Department, my office oversees fire inspections, fire investigations, and the public education team. Also, since DC is kind of a unique place, I also act as more of the state fire marshal as well. So overseeing code changes, a lot of policy, and a lot of stuff that would happen at state level, we do at the district level. So we have a team that goes out. Our inspectors are broken down into both geographical and technical. So geographical handle all different parts of the city. Our technical team handles everything from hazmat to fireworks to anything that might be out of the ordinary. Our fire investigators go out to every fire that occurred in the city, work to determine the origin and cause. We work on a task force with the ATF and MPD to investigate major incidents. And then we also have our PEBED team, which does public education outreach, fire safety visits, all the stuff that gets wrapped up with that. So there's a lot that's going on in our office every day. And, you know, every day is just kind of balancing those needs and trying to make sure we address what's going on in the city.
And I know that you had previously worked as a battalion chief and as a fire investigator earlier in your career, but what kind of an adjustment was this adapting to, you know, the myriad things you just listed?
Yeah. So I've held a lot of different roles and ranks in the department. A lot of my career was spent on a shift work schedule, which is a 24 on, 72 hours off. So the position I'm in now is a day work schedule. So that's a big adjustment right there to begin with. But, you know, a lot of at the rank that I'm at, most of the roles are administrative level like that. So kind of to be expected. So, you know, the adjustment with home and family life and coming to work every day was something that was new, you know, and then just dealing with more of a policy, more administrative role, as opposed to more of an operational role. That was a big change too, you know, but it's been almost 2 years now. So I think I'm fully adjusted. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And what have been some of the most important things you've learned in adjusting to that administrative aspect about fire safety, leadership, public engagement that maybe you touched on previously in some of your roles, but are a little bit newer in this one?
Yeah, you know, it's just, it's the amount of impact that we can have, right? So as a line officer, as a battalion chief, you know, you're impacting a much smaller area, whether that's, you know, a specific part of the city or a geographical area, but really being able to work with all different aspects of the city, you know, working on everything from, you know, safety in a restaurant to home fire safety to everything that we do has an impact across, you know, all different types of occupancies, all different populations, all different geographical areas, and just seeing how wide that can be and trying to make the most impact to, you know, the people that need the most has been the most important.
And I remember when I spoke with you last, I think it was late summer 2020 for a story about sleep. But I remember you saying during that interview that you started with the DC Fire Department while you were still a student at AU. I'm curious, what sparked that interest for you? If you had family that, you know, were firefighters previously, or if this was something that kind of was uniquely yours?
Yeah, so I did not have any family in the fire service or emergency services. You know, I know a lot of people do, So I came to DC to go to AU as undergrad. And I had been a volunteer in New Jersey where I grew up doing EMS work and fireworks. So I was kind of used to that environment. It was something I enjoyed doing. When I came down to the area, I looked for other volunteer opportunities and had to go out to Prince George's County because, you know, there's no volunteers in DC. So I did a lot of time out there and really enjoyed it. And I volunteered with a lot of members who were DC firefighters. At the time there was the application process, the testing process was every 5 or 6 years at that point. Yeah. So I was very fortunate to be able to hit it right at the right time and went through that process at the recommendation. A lot of people, did fairly well and then ended up in the hiring process and got hired, started the academy between my junior and senior year of undergrad.
Going back to when you were starting to volunteer a little bit in New Jersey, do you remember what it was that attracted you to that line of work or wanting to explore that in some way?
Yeah. So at the time, my town, it was a small town, and they had a program where kids that were volunteering could leave school during the day if there was an emergency call that came out. Right. So I would be in classes and see people, get up and leave class and be gone and doing all this cool stuff while I was sitting, in whatever class, being bored. So that seemed like a good time to me and something that was good to learn. So that was kind of what initially attracted me to it. And then, I started getting more involved and learning different aspects of the field and really started enjoying.
And can you walk me through what it was like during your training schedule with DC and you're trying to finish up your undergrad degree at the same time, how you balanced those two things, how you made that work and how relieved you were, I guess, when it was done?
Yeah, so that was definitely a challenging time, time management I learned from then on was something that was going to be super important. So I actually got notified that I was going to be hired at the end of my junior year, they were trying to put me in a class. I think it was April, and it was before finals, and I wouldn't have been able to complete that semester. So I was able to defer the academy class to start in June. I started on June 14th, so that was in the middle of summer break.
Yeah.
So the academy ran, a normal schedule, normalish, for 7 in the morning till 3 or 4 in the afternoon. So I structured my schedule for fall semester senior year to do block classes at night. Okay. So I would go to the academy during the day, do all that stuff, come home, shower, then go to my classes at night. The academy ended around October, which was, great. Cause then, I focused on school, but then I was on shift work. Right. So then, fortunately, a lot of my professors were very sympathetic to my cause I tried to keep them in the loop. And, fortunately, the shift schedule for us is set a year, 20 years in advance. Right. We know when we're working very far ahead of time. So I was able to tell them like, hey, these are the classes I will miss. Can I do something to make up the work or anything else? And there was really only one class where the professor was like, no, this isn't going to work. And I actually took a different class. And then, I realized after the fact that the class I missed out on was kind of a joke and I could have definitely missed the class that I had to miss. It wouldn't have been a problem, but that was one time, but all the other professors were great. I was able to, manage around my shift schedule. There were several times, once you become, graduate from the fire academy, you're a probationary firefighter for a period of time where you have to take tests, do practical skills when you're out in the firehouses. So I would literally be studying my probationary studies during the day.
Yeah.
At night, we do what's called watch, where you're up for a certain period of time to make sure, answer the phones and deal with any calls that come in. So when I was on watch, I would be studying for final exams or writing papers or taking care of my school stuff at night and the firehouse stuff during the day. So it was definitely a balancing act, but fortunately, I made it through, graduated on time, which my parents were very happy about, and it seems to have worked out.
Do you remember your first non-probationary assignment, what that was like, what kind of the emotions were of kind of reaching that point and what you carried into that assignment?
Yeah. I mean, so when we get our assignments, right, that's through the probationary period. And then, once you finish probation, that's kind of where you're at. So right. I was assigned to 19 Engine, which is on Pennsylvania Avenue in Southeast DC. It was, an area of the city that I didn't know much about. AU is very, far located upper Northwest. I was familiar with downtown, but really the other parts of the city, I didn't know that much about. So it was really a great opportunity to, see other areas, different cultures, different ways of life, everything that's going on that, I really didn't have any background on. And it really, I think it really helped me grow in my career and my professional life, just seeing, how the different parts of the city interact with each other, what different priorities are in different communities, and really just trying to work best to interact with and to really learn the most about, you know, the people that we serve throughout the city. And it really was pretty beneficial.
And I know there's that probationary period, as you mentioned, but how much of those initial stages, years, you know, I don't know what period of time, but is just learning on the fly? And what would you say is the most difficult part of just getting used to responding to calls, to the routine, to any aspect of taking on this job?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's a saying that, you know, firefighting is kind of always learning, right? You know, I learn stuff every day now. I'm still learning every day. So just because, you know, the probation process might end, you know, that learning process doesn't stop. You know, there's always different skills you have to pick up on. You get more advanced there. You have to learn different parts of the city or your area. When you go to different assignments, you have to learn what's unique about that firehouse, about that community. So the learning really never stops. So, but really just, you know, trying to get on the same page as everybody, right? So, you know, I was coming from a volunteer organization into a professional organization. There's a lot more rules and standards you need to follow, making sure that you're, you know, performing the way that you need to. You know, DC's got a lot of history. The fire department's very, very well known as being very aggressive and very advanced and being very effective. So learning the different techniques that go along with that, you know, there's always little tips and tricks of the trade that, you know, that you pick up on from working with different people and just learning how to do things a little bit differently or learning how, where you can speed up in certain areas or anything like that. And that's really the nuances of the job is really, once you get the basics down, you know, learning how to do those little unique things that really make you more effective and so you can serve the community better is always something that's going on.
And physically with, you know, taking on that initially, are you running? Are you lifting weights initially? Like how do you get prepared for the physical component and how have you been able to stay prepared with that over the course of your career?
Yeah. So when you're doing the entrance exam now, there's a process called the CPAT, which is a nationally certified, it's the candidate physical agility testing or training, pretty much a national standard for entrance for firefighters. And that's fairly well documented what you need to do. You know, there's a stair climb, there's an obstacle course, there's time components to that. You know, when I got hired, it was more of a DC specific obstacle course. Right. So it was a little bit less known about what we had to do. So I practiced by, you know, doing a lot of cardio, doing a lot of running, stairs, doing some weightlifting, that kind of stuff. You know, I'm kind of naturally a smaller person. So some of the heavier exercises, some of the, you know, I'm also kind of short. So stuff where I had to reach up pretty high was challenging for me, but I was able to get through all that. But really cardio and endurance stuff has been, you know, the most helpful. You know, when you're putting on the gear and you're going to fire or training or anything, you know, it takes a big toll on your body. The extra weight from all that stuff, the heat definitely takes a lot out of you too. Yep. So having that cardio, having that endurance has been really helpful. Even to this day.
And when you first started, did you have your sights set on any sort of specialization? You know, did you want to become an investigator down the road? Did you, you know, see a management role like the one you're in now is something you aspired to? Or did that just come over time and kind of learning more about the department?
Yes, I think it really came over time. So, I knew when I got hired, when I became a firefighter, you know, I wanted to advance, you know, when I could, right? So in DC, you can't start testing for an officer position until you got 5 years on the job and then you can test for sergeant and everything. I was also a justice major at AU. So I was, you know, very interested in law enforcement and the legal system. So when the opportunity came up to be a fire investigator, that was kind of, you know, really something that I was really interested in because it kind of took my interest in the legal system and law enforcement and combined it with the fire service. And it was really kind of a perfect fit at the time. So when that came up, I really hopped on the opportunity, started learning about it, became really interested in the background of it and the complexities of it. And then got a position as a fire investigator, which was a really great experience. And then just kind of seeing, you know, what the other opportunities are, different officer ranks from working with different people, you learn, you know, how officers can affect, you know, the firehouse and the shift and how those can be positive or negative influences. And from learning and dealing with different personalities, just kind of seeing how, you know, how myself, you know, how I thought I could handle some of those situations and how I wanted to be in those more in those leadership roles.
And what was the learning curve like going into a fire investigator role? How long did it take before you felt really comfortable with, you know, I can walk into a, you know, to post fire and kind of get a better sense for what's going on?
Yeah. So we're fortunate in DC fortunate or unfortunate, I guess, depending on how you look at it, whereas, you know, we run a decent amount of fires, right? So there's a lot of opportunity there to learn and to get hands-on and to see different things. You know, some areas of the country might run, you know, a handful of incidents a year. We're running a handful of incidents a week or a day sometimes. So, you know, there's a lot more opportunity in the DC area to get that experience early on. So obviously the training is pretty intense to begin with, and it covers a lot of fire science and, you know, different investigative techniques and everything else. And learning that stuff was a lot to take on. But then when you really are able to apply that, to walk into a fire scene and to, you know, get hands-on and really see how that stuff interacts, it all starts to make sense a lot more. And then so seeing that over and over again, and you can realize different patterns and different things to look for, you know, you can get comfortable quicker, I think, doing that kind of job where you're busier, as opposed to somewhere where you don't have that opportunity to apply those skills all the time. So going through that that frequency of incidents that we have here really helped to get myself comfortable, you know, somewhat early on to really be confident in my decision making, to really see how these things were working out, and really help to make me a stronger investigator as time went on.
And I know you've been at the department for what, 18 years now?
Yeah. Yep.
How would you say the profession has changed most, you know, from standards to technology to certain practices? And how have you been able to adapt to those changes over time?
Yeah. So, I mean, technology has definitely been a huge impact, right? So, I mean, I remember when I first started, I got hired in 2004. You know, there were still typewriters in the firehouse, you know, they weren't really used, you know, but they were still there, right? It's kind of funny. You know, when I first started, we had printers that would spit out our incident, you know, when we would get a run, you know, the rip off, the tear off paper on the sheets with the side. I can't really describe it, but, and that was, you know, fairly technologically advanced at the time. You know, I remember when I first started, we had all our forms that we had to fill out. They were all online. They were digital. And I thought that was really advanced, you know, for an agency our size. And looking back, it was. And so, I mean, yeah. I think that DC in some parts, we've been kind of at the leading edge on some of that stuff. Some things we're still a little slow on, but definitely that transition, right? So going from, you know, those paper tear-offs to now every fire apparatus has a laptop in the front. You can get information a lot faster. You can get updated information from an incident you're going to instantaneously. You can pull up maps. You can, you know, get background information. You can see an overview. There's a lot of technology, and that's evolving every single day, right? So, you know, I think the DC has been very good in embracing a lot of that technology and integrating it in kind of what we do, but at the same time, still maintaining that tradition, right? Our apparatus drivers, they still are required to know where they're going, right? We don't rely on GPS. You know, there's a knowledge of the area that they have to maintain, which makes us unique, but also makes us that much better, right? Because they know the intricacies of the neighborhood, right? The GPS might be wrong, but they know they take a certain alley, it's got to get them to a certain place. They know what alleys they can access in different areas in different parts of the city, right? All these things, you know, make us better at responding to these emergencies. And then you can use the technology on the backside to see, okay, you know, if we can get to this part, can we get to the next part, right? And kind of merging those two things together, I think, is what makes us really effective.
And I can imagine you've worked with hundreds of different people over the last 18 years, but I would wonder, I guess, from that, among those people, what do you find are the most valuable traits, and what have you, I guess, valued most or wanted to model the most in yourself? Is it something like quick instincts, a quick memory, communication? What would you say are some of those things that have stood out to you over the years and you have kind of tried to model yourself after as you build your career?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've definitely worked with a lot of different people, you know, and especially working with different officers. There was always this kind of saying that, you know, you can learn as much, if not more, from a bad officer than you could from a good officer, right? Because you would see how things that you didn't like about that a certain trait, how that affects people. So I would always try to pick up on that and kind of say, like, okay, this is happening. I want to make sure I'm not like that, right? I want to make sure I'm not a person that does X. And then a lot of things that you talked about, right? Being able to make a quick decision, right? When we're on a fire ground, when you're on a medical call, when you're dealing with an investigation, right, you need to be able to make a decision, stick with it, and do it quickly. So having that quick decision-making, I think is a skill that's really necessary for a lot of the firefighters that we work with. You know, having good interpersonal skills and dealing with the community, right? So much of what we do is interacting with the community. So much of my job now is interacting with the community, making sure you're listening and being attentive to what, you know, the needs are, you know, trying to really understand what the issues are, because sometimes what starts off as the issue is not really what's going on. So trying to get down to the bottom line of what's happening and how we can positively, you know, affect that situation. And just really, you know, I think there's something you could take away from everybody that you work with, right? Whether it's, you know, the probationer that's just starting now, you know, the most junior person in the department, to, you know, somebody who's been on the job for 30 plus years, you know, who's, you know, been all different parts of the city. There's always something you can take from different people that you're working with. And I try to be open to try to see, you know, what's something new that I might be able to take away, or what's something new that I've learned that I didn't know before.
You mentioned at the top of this, in the last couple of years, having transitioned off of shift work. I'm curious what that was like, what you, I guess, miss most about that, and what you miss least about that lifestyle.
Yeah. So, you know, throughout my career, I had been on day work for, you know, a few stints here and there. But, you know, it seems like now this is the schedule I will be at for the, you know, for the long haul.
Right.
You know, the shift work schedule is something that, you know, I always appreciated, but you don't really fully appreciate it until it's gone. You know, it's definitely taxing on the body sometimes, especially if you're at a busy company or you have a busy night and you're up, you know, for 24 hours. But then having those 3 days off to, you know, recover, to, you know, spend time with family, to take care of things that you wouldn't necessarily think of, right? So, you know, every weekend now is dedicated to running errands or grocery store or these things that, you know, I would normally plug in on like a Tuesday or Wednesday when it was quiet, is now time that, you know, where the rest of the world is doing all these things. You're kind of plugged in there too. So there's some downside there, but there's also the plus side where you're on a normal schedule. So the weekends when everybody else is off, you're off, and you can spend time doing, you know, family or kids school events or anything else. Those are times when you're already naturally around. I can make sure now I don't miss, you know, any of my daughter's softball games because of shift work, right? I can make sure that, you know, for any performances that they're doing at school, I'm always there. So there's definitely the benefit there of having, you know, when having smaller kids like I do now, and as they're growing up, you know, having the ability to be there for all those events that you want to make sure you have, without feeling like you have to miss something at work too, has really been, that's been a plus side to it.
And throughout your career, you know, most people in their profession aren't woken up by alarm bells, or, you know, they're eating and then something happens, they have to, you know, move at the drop of a hat. How do you turn that intensity off after a shift? And is that something that takes time to figure out? And what worked for you in trying to address that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think being on shift work, it's almost easier to leave everything at work, right? Because when you leave, right, you're not, you know, they're not, unless it's a major catastrophe, you're not getting called back, right? As a battalion chief, as an officer, right, I wasn't getting calls in the middle of the night about stuff that's going on. You know, when I was on duty, I was on duty. And when I was off duty, it was very clear. Like that was it. There might be some emails that come in, but most of the time you could handle it when you get to work. Being an administrative role now and kind of being in charge of the division I'm in charge of, you know, there's something always happening, right? There's emails that are coming through at night. There's phone calls that come in. We have inspectors working all hours. We have investigators working 24 hours. So there's always people doing something in the city. And sometimes that requires me to get involved with it, right? So it's harder now to kind of turn off the work side of things, because there's always something that's going on, and there's always something that I kind of need to know about or weigh in on. You know, fortunately, we work with a ton of great people, and they're great at making decisions, and we try to give them all the autonomy that they have, you know, but some things still, you know, need to get notified for. So it was almost easier on shift work to be able to turn it off, because once you left the firehouse, you were done, right? You were back to being civilian or whatever you want to call it, and on with your day. Whereas now it's harder to turn things off, where there's always something happening.
Gotcha. And how did, over the course of your career in the last, you know, 5 years or so, how did fire marshal become a possibility for you? And what was your reaction to reaching that rank?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a good question. You know, fire marshal was, I don't think anything that I was ever, you know, truly striving for. Obviously I had experience in fire investigation. So, you know, I knew that some spots were coming up. I knew I was in the running for a promotion to deputy fire chief at the time. And I knew one of the spots that was coming up was fire prevention, because the former fire marshal was retiring.
Right.
You know, I really was able to articulate how my experience in the division in the past could really, you know, gave me some unique insight, which I think was definitely helpful in getting the position, you know, but also, you don't know what you don't know, right? So when I was able to get the position, there's so much more involved to the position than I ever would have imagined, right? From doing code changes to dealing with different task forces to working with different agencies. And really, until you get in a role like this or almost any of the division heads that we have, you really don't know the intricacies and how much you have to take on until you're really in that role, right? You really can't. So I was excited about the opportunity, right? I knew that it was something that I had some background in and I could be interested in. And I like, you know, interacting with people. I like trying to, you know, be an example and trying to be a leader. So I knew that division had a lot of people and had a lot of opportunity there. And so when I was able to get that position, I was excited to have that opportunity. At the same time, I was instantly, taken back, like, okay, like now what, like, what do I not know? And I very quickly learned there was a lot. So trying that transition period and trying to get full understanding of everything that's going on was a big challenge, but I think we're pretty good at.
And is it just a constant cycle of busyness year round? Are there certain seasons for code changes and adapting to that are particular busy seasons, or is that pretty much a constant, you know, something is always pressing?
So definitely something is always happening, right? And something is always pressing. And, you know, if I have a day where I don't have, you know, a handful of meetings and other things going on, it's almost like something's wrong, right? Because I'm so used to the constant hecticness of it, you know, but it's also something that I enjoy, right? I enjoy being busy and I enjoy interacting with everybody. You know, there's different cycles to things. The wintertime definitely gets busier for fires. You know, everybody's in the house, people are using different heating sources, you know, things are closed up a little bit more. There's the potential there for, you know, a higher injury, a fatality rate, right? It's a lot of things that we try to do on the front end to try to make sure we're educating the public about what's happening. Summertime is a little slower for fires traditionally, but then, you know, we have 4th of July where we're very involved in fireworks and permitting and everything that goes along with that, and then injuries. And so, I mean, there's different challenges at different times of year, but it's never something that kind of dies down. It's always the next thing that's happening.
And you touched on it, but as we get closer to winter and as folks start turning on their heat, what advice just on a general level might you offer people on a fire safety standpoint?
Yeah. So, I mean, we are always trying to beat the drum of fire safety, right? We're always trying to get the message out, and it's really nothing earth-shattering, right? A lot of the most basic things are the things that we see over and over again. So first of all, smoke detectors, smoke alarms. We want to make sure everybody has smoke alarms in their house, outside their bedrooms, make sure they work, test them. If they're in the district, we can come out and give you a free smoke detector. We can install it. We can do a home fire safety visit. You know, we want to make sure that when you're cooking, right, you're not leaving things unattended on the stove. You're keeping a close eye on things. You're not cooking while you're impaired. You're not wearing loose clothing that could ignite when you're in the area. Extension cords, we know, are a big issue. People run extension cords throughout their house. They get caught up under furniture. That can then, you know, cause an issue. So we want to make sure that you don't use extension cords in the place of where a permanent wire should be. You know, that you're keeping an eye on them. They're in good condition. In the wintertime, we had a lot of space heater issues. We want to make sure you give clearance to those space heaters, you know, 3 to 5 feet around those. Make sure they're not right up on, you know, bedding or clothing or anything else, and making sure those are plugged directly into the wall. They draw a lot of amps and volts and everything, and they can be really dangerous. You know, we know our vulnerable population a lot is the elderly. So we always want to make sure that they're using all these good fire safety tips, but also, you know, they're interacting with the community, that we have community members might be able to check on them or make sure they have what they need, make sure the smoke detectors are in good shape. You know, just all the things that we're constantly preaching throughout the year, just when in the wintertime, it all comes together a little bit more. And it's that message is even more important.
And what kind of fire safety equipment should somebody have in their house? What's a reasonable expectation for someone to have? And in terms of a plan for individuals or for families, what should that look like? Can you have a plan? And how do you even begin to do that?
Yes. Yeah, so definitely having a plan, right? So first, let's start with at the beginning, right? So in DC, all new residential buildings have to be sprinkled, right? Which is a huge benefit, because we know that sprinkler systems help to save lives, give you the time to get out of that building. And that's so critical, right? Having that sprinkler is almost like having a firefighter. firefighter just hanging out in your house, right? If a small fire happens, that sprinkler goes off, that fire is going to be suppressed. And we know a lot of times that gives people time to get out. It can reduce the rate of injury and death. And it's so important. So if you live in a newer house or if you're renovating your house, you know, getting those sprinkler systems in there is required by code, but it's so important. And we advocate for that. You know, if you don't have sprinkler systems, you know, we recommend having a fire extinguisher in the house, usually in the kitchen area, knowing that people know how to use it, you know, but really knowing your limitations too. If it's a big fire, don't stand there and try to mess around with it. Getting out, calling 911, you know, making sure everybody's accounted for. Having a plan is so important. You know, we have a lot of these resources on our website, which is fems.dc.gov. People can go to, they can pull that, you know, download all these fire safety tips, but making a plan, right? Having a meeting point to go to when you get out of the house, making sure everybody's accounted for, you know, sometimes making sure that you grab medication or anything else that you might need, you know, in case of emergency. But really, if there's a fire, making sure everybody gets out, making sure everybody's accounted for, and then making sure that when the firefighters do show up, you can let them know like, hey, everybody's out. It lets us know that, you know, we are still going to search the house. We're still going to make sure everybody's okay. But, yep. You know, it gives us a little more ability to handle the situation. Knowing that there's nobody trapped, knowing that we don't need to go in and save somebody right away. So all these things are these big fire safety tips. Everything's on our website. I definitely encourage everybody to download that, you know, have a plan, practice it, right? Doing fire drills in your whole house. They call it exit drills in the home. It's a big push to really, you know, just like you would at school and have a school fire drill, you want to do it at house to make sure everybody knows how to get out, where to go, all those things.
And this is more of a summer question, but in your 18 years, have you ever had a 4th of July off? And does that holiday in particular put you on edge? Just knowing, I imagine, the activity that happens on a day like that.
Yeah. So I think I've had a couple 4th of Julys off when I was, you know, in different assignments, not in fire investigations and obviously not now as a fire marshal, but it always gives us a lot of concern, right? Fireworks are incredibly dangerous. You know, right. In DC, certain fireworks are legal. Just because they're legal doesn't mean they're safe, right? And the fireworks that are legal, they can still, you know, burn you, they can still injure you, they can still destroy property, right? All these things, it's really dangerous. And then we know illegal fireworks that get brought into the city, those are super dangerous, right? They explode, they can go in the air. We've unfortunately had serious injuries. We've had deaths over the years occurred through the fireworks. And we really want to just make sure everybody's safe, right? We want to make sure everybody can enjoy the 4th of July, enjoy the summertime, and not spend time in the emergency room, not blow off, you know, hands or fingers or anything else, right? Nobody wants that. So really the push for us, you know, starts beginning in springtime for a big public safety push to make sure everybody knows, first of all, what's legal, what's illegal, and then the best way to enjoy the 4th of July. And we always recommend coming down to the National Mall. It's a great show. We have our inspectors down there making sure all right. That stuff's safe too, and really leaving it to the professionals and enjoying the time with everybody else in the community and just watching the show and not having to worry about, you know, ending up in the emergency room.
Just one last question for you. You know, you've been doing this for 18 years, you know, now in a very high managerial position. You know, have had a number of different roles over the years, but what keeps you excited about this work and what keeps you most engaged, would you say?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think every day is different, right? And no two incidents are the same, no two fires are the same, you know, no 2 days in my office here are the same. There's always something new, right? And like I said before, I'm always learning something new every day. You know, I think that's what keeps me really excited to see what's going to happen next, to see, you know, how we're going to be challenged, to see what the next task is that we have to do. You know, I really enjoy what I do, right? I enjoy working with the people throughout the department, but especially in my division here, we have great people that work here. They're passionate about what they do. They want people to be safe. They want to, you know, reduce fires, reduce injuries, reduce deaths. I mean, that's really you know, there's not a lot of other places where you can see the impact that you have on a daily basis. And when we see, you know, people that have time to get out before an emergency happened because of some planning that they did, you know, or when we see fires that were able to be kept small because of the efforts of our outreach team or anything else, right? A lot of the things that we do, you can see the benefits and seeing that and being able to have that impact across, you know, so many different parts of the city is really what keeps us engaged, you know, really every day.
Mitchell, thank you for taking the time and, you know, a lot of great resources for people to look at and, you know, best of luck as we get toward wintertime.
Yes, Andrew, thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you and looking forward to talking to you again.
That was the winter episode of the 30 Minutes On podcast from American University Magazine. Thank you so much to our guest, Mitchell Canary, for joining us to chat about his career with DC Fire and how we can stay safe this winter and beyond. Be on the lookout for our Winter 2023 magazine, which hits mailboxes soon, and read up on other challenges being tackled by members of the AU community, from the transition to a cashless society to water waste to neighborhood change. Let us know what you think about the podcast or the Winter magazine by emailing magazine@american.edu or chatting with us on Twitter or Instagram at @AU_AmericanMag. You can find previously recorded podcast episodes and subscribe with Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Amazon. A full transcript of the show is available on our website at american.edu/magazine. Our theme music is Laurel Breeze by Evan Schaefer. Thanks for listening, and stay warm, but also stay safe. We'll see you next time.